Morning. Delighted to welcome you all to the courtroom, and we have some special student guests. One group has not arrived. Are they expected? Okay.
Are they intended?
And Privets High School students, would you stand, please? Thank you for coming, and you may be seated. As I think everyone in the courtroom knows, the students are here with a program cleverly entitled Court with Class. Students around the state are invited to join us for an oral argument. And if they are deciding to come, we send them materials about the case. They may engage in activities relating to the case. They come and hear an oral argument. And then they will meet with a justice of this court who's assigned for that day to meet with students and anyone else who wishes to attend the session. The discussion will be on the procedures of the court, not the substantive issues involved. If anyone would like a copy of a summary of the case, if you'd raise your hand, we will give it to you. All right. I'm going to, before I introduce the court, merely say to the students and to the attorneys present that, as you all know, this court engages in outreach, and especially to teachers and to students. And we will continue to do that and expand also into a program on civic studies that is sponsored by retired Justice Sandra Day O'Connor. And I call the students' attention and the lawyers' attention to the fact that Justice O'Connor will be here at the State Bar on May 6th. And she will be talking about that civic education as well as other issues generally relating to selection of judges. And her appearances at the State Bar are open to the public. So if any of you are able to come, you are welcome to do that. Let me introduce the court to you. I'm Shirley Abrahamson. I'm the Chief Justice. Seated next to me on my right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley, who will be speaking with the groups at noon and is a former teacher herself. And to her right is Justice David Crossley, and to his right, Justice Annette Ziegler. Starting to my left is Justice Patrick Rooks, Justice Patience Rogenfatt, and Justice Michael Gableman. With those introductions made, I'll call our second case, 08AP2342CR, State versus Dwight Glenn Jones. Representing Mr. Jones is Ellen Hennick of the Office of the State Public Defender. Counsel, you may proceed.
May it please the court, my name is Ellen Hennick, and I represent Dwight Glenn Jones. The issue that brings us here today is really twofold. The first, but they're very closely related. The heart of the issue here is whether, when there's available counsel, as set forth in the Administrative Code in PD 2.04, and you are 4 months before trial, whether Mr. Jones, who never was found by anyone to have asked for a new attorney, whatever his reason, everyone agreed it was not for purposes of delay, should have been given a new attorney. And that plays out here in two separate issues. The first is whether the trial court misused its discretion in trying to apply the balancing test in Lomax when it failed to give him a new attorney. And the second issue, which you do not have to reach if you decide that the court misused its discretion, is whether he had a constitutional right to that available counsel, that there was no interest of justice sufficient to trump. As for the first argument, basically what happened here is that Mr. Jones, who is deaf and who speaks primarily, although not entirely, through sign language, and who was in a slightly different position than he had been. I will admit he had had prior cases. He was in a slightly different position here, though, because his hearing aids had been broken at the time of his arrest. So whatever his hearing abilities may have been in earlier cases, they were certainly much more severely curtailed here. He had an attorney who had a mustache, which makes lip reading, or however you want to phrase it, I forget what the term that they were using in
speech reading.
Speech reading, thank you. Speech reading much more difficult.
Counselor, to what extent is his hearing impairment relevant to the circuit court's exercise of discretion based on the information that was presented to her?
Talking about the initial decision.
I am. Justice LeMayus' decision.
Okay. All right. With Justice LeMayus, it plays in two ways. One, there was not much of an exploration of that, and I will admit that Judge Maroney subsequently found that the biggest problem here between the attorney and my client was not that he was deaf. However, it played in another way. It played in trying to determine whether there would have been a delay in this case at all. Judge LeMayus, at the time she made her decision, and in her denial of the post-conviction motion, says that part of what was going through her head was that there might be a delay because we would have to get interpreters, and that was a difficult process. So it may have been playing in her mind to that extent. And to that extent, it may have weighed against my client because arrangements were more difficult. What she says in her post-conviction motion is, one of the things I was considering was I might have to put off the trial because we had had some difficulty getting interpreters. It's not clear that that was ever correct, and it's also not clear when you look at the transcript of November 30th. He does not appear to have realized at the time she's making her decision that, in fact, there was a trial set, and it was set for way out in February. And the basis for my saying that is that after she deals with the issue of the attorney, she then turns and says, oh, you need a trial date, when in fact there's been one all along. So I think it does play into what she was concerned about in terms of how she was trying to weigh inconvenience. I'm not sure it plays in a way it should have, but I think that it certainly does there. I think that it plays in to a lesser extent as between trial counsel and the client, because, as I said, Judge Maroney did find that that was not the primary basis of the difficulty between them. Now, it's very difficult for anybody ever to know when you've got communication and a client who works almost entirely visually to what extent it plays into other things. Might the disagreement have been easier to resolve? I don't know. I don't think anybody knows for sure.
Okay. My next question is, does the hearing loss play into the constitutional right to counsel of choice as you see it, or would the right stand as an independent right regardless of whether there was a hearing loss issue here?
I think it's irrelevant to the constitutional right, except to the very limited extent that there may be something quirky in this case that may play out in what constitutes an inconvenience that could trump that right. Although I am very, very hesitant to say that a client who is deaf and needs accommodation because of communication, and there was no doubt also here that he needed sign interpreters at least in the courtroom, because when you think about the way a courtroom is laid out, you don't have a quick face-to-face. You're often seeing a lot of people from a distance. whatever he might be able to do one-on-one with speech reading is not possible in that courtroom. But except to that extent, as to whether he has the right, it plays no role. It may play a role in how you analyze it case-specifically.
Thank you. Counsel, do you agree or disagree that under the administrative code, the section dealing with a person's right to refuse a specific attorney, do you agree or disagree that under that section you still have to go through and ask the court for...
I believe that you still have to ask the court, but I believe that the role of the court should be somewhat limited. I think that the role of the court, particularly where you've got a case like this one, where the request for new counsel, at least the one the court becomes aware of, is 4 months before trial. The original one, because my client wasn't quite sure where to direct it, goes to some extent. He's already writing to the public defender's office back in July, 2 months after the case starts. But however you parse that out, I think the role for the court is that the court has a role in the efficient administration of justice. I think, however, that's limited because counsel is available, and I think both under Lomax, in terms of a misuse of discretion, and under a constitutional analysis, you get into weighing out what the inconvenience to the court is. And I think what I'm suggesting to you is that where there's really no support in the record that anything would change as to trial, the court's role is really quite limited. It has to go through the court, but the court's role ought to be quite limited. Once you weigh out, you know, how far in advance of trial or how little inconvenience there would be against the request, given that counsel is available, once you say, hey, it doesn't put anything off, that's pretty much the end of the court's role in this case, I think, or I think it should have been.
Is the court's role any different than if this were not a criminal case and a client wants to change lawyers?
I don't see that there's any reason that it should be. Now, what's interesting is if you look carefully at Lomax and at Pfeiffer, both of those are cases, and Pfeiffer says it straight out, this is a case in which you don't just have a request to counsel, you've got a request to counsel coupled with a request for a continuance. Although Lomax doesn't specifically say that, it's clearly the same situation because the request is on the day of trial. Both of those cases spend a lot of time talking about, well, in this context, we would need a substantial breakdown between the attorney and the client. And I think the reason you're seeing so much discussion of that is because they're weighing out what's clearly going to be a delay. And in Pfeiffer, it's not just that the trial is going to be put off. They're bringing a judge in from another county. So there's going to be significant inconvenience, not only to witnesses, but to that judge who's coming in from the other county. Obviously, scheduling was an issue there. So they're trying to weigh it out. And what they're really saying, I think, in Lomax and Pfeiffer is, if it's going to be a severe disruption, then you need something really weighty. And I think part, although it doesn't discuss it, part of the reason you may get to the concept of a substantial breakdown there is because if you have a substantial breakdown, then you have a problem under the Sixth Amendment right to effective assistance of counsel. You've got a fair trial problem. So obviously, even if it's a delay, you don't want to go forward if you've reached that level. I think that's a very different question than the question you've got here, in a sense, which is there's no evidence in the record that the trial would have had to be delayed. There was 4 months. It's true that the hearing on the motion didn't happen till the end of November, but that was partially, again, because my client needed interpreters, and I'm uncomfortable suggesting to this court that the rule ought to be different if it takes a little bit longer because he needs an interpreter. So he's making his request way in advance. No witnesses are involved. There's no putting off of the trial that's involved. 4 months is plenty of time. Now, I know that there was some discussion in the record that this was a complicated case because there were a lot of counts. The truth is, this is a case involving stealing cars, and there's really a couple of separate incidents that lead to multiple charges for each of those incidents. It's not that complicated a case. On top of that, you've got my client who is willing to say from the very beginning, we're having a problem here. He has fewer avenues, and I think maybe it does play in this sense, Justice Rogenczak. He has fewer avenues for exploring that. He's been writing to his attorney through May, through June. The attorney doesn't write back. Now, many clients would pick up the telephone at that point. This client, because of his deafness and because there's no TTY, does not have that option. So he doesn't have some options for resolving problems that perhaps some others might have.
Ms. Hennick?
Yes.
I'm having trouble figuring out how these two issues of misuse discretion or erroneous exercise of discretion and the constitutional right to available counsel fit together in this fact situation, which is a little complicated with two trial judges involved. So I'm going to ask you, how do you think this case, this opinion, should be written? And you keep saying, well, you don't want to emphasize and make a special rule for someone that may have a hearing disability. So tell me what the opinion would look like.
Okay, I think that there are two ways to write this opinion. The narrow way to write this opinion, and I say that because of the way these two issues actually fit together. The narrow way to write this opinion is to say that you need to apply Lomax, but you need to be aware, courts, that Lomax is a case in which the request comes on the eve of trial. What you need to be doing is what Lomax said, which is to balance the timeliness of the request against all of the various types of inconvenience and against what the problem is. The closer you get to trial, the more it may be that you need to get into what the relationship between the attorney and the client is. But if you're far enough out, you may not need to go there, or at least not in any real meaningful way. You may want to assure yourself that it's not for purposes of delay, but you don't want to do any more than that. You're having a problem, fine, plenty of time, you get a new attorney the first time, because remember that we're talking about available counsel and the Administrative Code 2.04. Now, there are
the assumption then you're making is that under the code, you're entitled to one shot at the lawyer.
Yes. Unless we get to the stage, which takes you completely out of it, where fair trial is at issue, in which case we may have a different problem.
Okay, so if you make your one shot without explaining why, or just saying I don't like him or her, then you're saying the trial court should balance this, quote, administrative right versus trial inconvenience.
Right, and the more inconvenience, the more weighty the reason may have to be.
Okay.
Yeah. If this
That's an administrative right. Suppose that wasn't in the administrative code. Would it make any difference in your analysis?
I think it does make a difference in my analysis to some extent, because I think that the court may have some additional interests that get involved there. Having to do with not wanting to give multiple attorneys, et cetera.
Well,
so it may, yeah.
Even under the code, isn't there some question as to whether the leave of the court is required before the substitution of attorneys may take place?
Well, I'm assuming that the leave of the court is required. The question is
what
question
that assumption might be founded on the form that's promulgated by the Public Defender's Office, which states that leave of the court is required.
Right. I believe leave of the court is required, but the question to me isn't whether you need leave of the court because I think the court has an interest. I'm not denying that the court has an interest. The question is, what should the court's inquiry be, I think, at this
point? What should the court want?
What should the court's inquiry be when you ask for that leave?
Right.
If a lawyer has made an appearance in the court or is shown as being counsel, can the lawyer get out without the court approval? Ever?
Well, I suppose if he dies. But short of that, it usually has required it.
The court doesn't.
And I don't mean to be flip, but I've had a case like that where I ended up having to write a letter to the court because I think somebody didn't understand what had happened and said there was no motion.
Got it.
I don't mean to be
okay. All right. So we've got the general rule concept of if it doesn't hurt anything, let them substitute counsel.
Right. Now, I think the analysis under...
Was there a goof here then?
I believe so. I believe because this, in a sense, ended up being decided piecemeal, you never got a weighting here.
You never got a what?
You never got the factors weighed. You got them each discussed at different times, but you never actually got it weighed. The first time, there was a lot of focus on what the reason was, some confusion by the trial court judge about what the effect on the case would be. You will find that that the trial court judge is discussing, well, we would have to put off the trial, or we might, or certainly in her post-conviction motion, she's saying that was going through her head. I don't think the record supports that. I think, as the Court of Appeals found the first time this went up, there's simply not support for that in the record. I think there was some confusion.
Counsel, Tim, let me ask you this. Is there anything in the record that shows that the lawyer who would have been appointed would have been available to try the case on the date set? Because this was set once, then it was reset in part because it would take a week and the court had a calendar issue, and then it was set and it had to be reset because there were no interpreters available, and there was about a month and a half or so. Then it was set for the February date, and then the end of November is when the motion was denied regarding new counsel. And I hear what you're saying, and I'm thinking back to being a trial court judge. Sometimes I'd say, look, if you know the lawyer is available and will try this case on the date set, fine. I have no issue with appointing a new lawyer. And then either they'd know that or didn't know that and would look into it. But do we know that that lawyer would have tried that case? Because this was set then for the third time for trial. And interpreters, as you know, are, you know, hearing impaired interpreters, sign interpreters for people who are deaf, are tough to pull together, given how many you need and what you need and how that all works and who's available in the pool. It's the same group of people I used to use in Washington County, so they're spread thin. Tell me, what's in the record to show this lawyer would have tried the case on that day?
Okay. We don't have a specific lawyer identified. What we do know is that the first trial date was about as close. The first trial date that was set was as close to the beginning of this case as the February trial date would have been to the motion hearing. Originally, it was set, and the attorney said, oh, yes, I can be ready to try it in 2 months. I'm assuming if one attorney could have, that probably others could have as well. Milwaukee is not a place where it has typically been difficult to identify and find lawyers for attorneys. I understand that occasionally happens up north, but that Milwaukee has not been one of those cases. But there's nothing specifically in the record, except for the fact that the first attorney could have gotten up to speed in that period of time, which suggests that a subsequent one could have.
I'm just curious. This is just a curiosity thing, but are there certain public defenders who handle hearing impaired cases and others that don't? Because that just hasn't been my experience. I mean, sometimes you have Spanish-speaking lawyers, and great, that's an added convenience because then you don't need an interpreter to interpret between someone who speaks another language. I mean, that's just a bonus. But I don't know. Are there special public defenders or people who sign or that you hire to deal with people who have
No, typically you're hiring an interpreter, although it is much quicker to hire an interpreter to come to an attorney-client visit where you're not dealing with court scheduling, nor are you dealing with multiple interpreters in the same way. So it's not as difficult to do, and I know because I've done it. I have used an interpreter, and this is actually in the record throughout most of this case. There was one occasion, and it's actually in the record, when I did not, but I did that as a means of assessment rather than as an attempt to be the attorney. I do happen to have a background in special education, which probably has helped me out here.
Your time is running short, and I'd like to have you address your second issue, especially in light of the Gonzalez-Lopez case.
Okay. Here's what I think is going on. I am aware that there is language, and I will concede that there is language from both this court and the United States Supreme Court that basically says indigent defendants do not have a right to counsel of choice. I think that is, in essence, a shorthand for a concept that is largely but not totally correct. I think what they're trying to say is you don't have a right to go, I want you, or I want you, or I want you. And I would agree with it to that extent. I think if you actually look at other case law, if you look at, for example, Ferretta, which is the key case on right to represent yourself, you clearly have the right if you're capable of representing yourself. In other words, if there is somebody else available to represent you, which in this case is yourself, to go ahead and reject the attorney. If you look at Kaplan and Drysdale, that case also talks about there's no right to counsel of choice, although you could be represented by a pro bono counsel, if your family could hire. So I don't think it's true that there's absolutely no right to choice. What there's not is a right to a specific attorney, which really doesn't make it all that different than when you've got hired counsel, because you can't just walk in off the street, as someone once tried to do with me, and hire me. I work for the public defender's office. I take cases that are appointed. You can't go and insist somebody represent you who you can't afford to pay. So, I mean, there's always been some limitation on that right. So here, and this is how the administrative code plays in, where there is other available counsel, in other words, another public defender or public defender appointed attorney available, I think that there is that right. Now, that right has never been an absolute right. Even when you have retained counsel, as Mr. Lomax and Mr. Pfeiffer found out, you can go in the day of trial or a couple of days before trial and say, I want a different attorney, and be told no because it is too disruptive to the court system. I think all of those same considerations would apply here. The indigent defendant would be in no different position. It's equally tenable or untenable for him to have a new attorney.
Well, on your narrow view of the case in writing the opinion, you are going to run up against erroneous exercise of discretion, aren't you?
Yes.
That's always a tough road to go against, to meet, right?
I think the big difference here is not in the trial court. I think when you look at this globally, where the difference probably comes in is standard of review, ultimately.
What do you mean by that?
If you're doing this as the judge is exercising the judge's discretion, your standard is that there is a misuse of discretion.
Right.
If you are doing this, that there is a constitutional right to counsel of choice, clearly the standard that's going to be applied is not going to be a misuse of discretion. And I've played a little bit with the concept of what that would look like. And I think what you get to is it becomes, to some extent, similar to what happens in a Fourth Amendment. I see my light is on. Can I finish this thought out? It becomes the facts are to be found by the trial court, because you're going to have some fact-finding about whether there was delay, there would be delay, that kind of thing. It would then be up to this court to apply that constitutional principle de novo to those facts. Now, you're probably closer to Fourth Amendment in that, to some extent, what you've got going, because there is a little bit of balancing of rights, is a little bit more totality of the circumstances. I'm not sure I would use that phrase. But I think that that's where the real difference is going to come in. It's going to come in on the level of review more than it's going to come in how you really look at it, if you're looking at it that there should have been a balancing.
Is this constitutional ground raised at the trial court?
Yes. The trial court did not deal with it because the trial court said that under your case law it could not. It was raised both times in the Court of Appeals. Court of Appeals took the same position. So you'll see it in a sentence or two. It's raised all the way along.
No forfeiture, then, of the issue?
No, it's been raised from the very beginning. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hennick. Eileen Frey, Assistant Attorney General representing the state of Wisconsin.
Yes, I am Assistant Attorney General Lee Prey, and I'm representing the state. I'm a little bit at a loss of where to begin because this case has been somewhat of a moving target in what the real issue is going on here. I had assumed that the real issue here was whether there was a constitutional right to reject the first appointed attorney. And I assumed that because of the fact-finding and the determination that when this case was remanded, that there really wasn't a breakdown in communication between Mr. Jones and his appointed attorney, and that there wasn't any argument in the brief to this court that that finding was clearly erroneous and that the Court of Appeals should not have upheld that finding. So I actually am going to begin with the second issue, which is the constitutional issue. And I think that it is clear by the cases of the United States Supreme Court and this Supreme Court that there is no constitutional right to choose an appointed attorney. Also, there is no support in the case law for the notion that there is a constitutional right to reject one's first appointed attorney. The two cases that are relied upon by Mr. Jones don't say anything like that. The Ferretta case is based on the very long, it's a 1975 case, based on the very long-standing proposition that a person has the constitutional right to represent themselves. In order to effect that right, they have to have the ability to waive all representation, not the specific representation of a specific attorney that they are having a difficulty with. And also, there's nothing in Ferretta that says that there, if you do waive representation, you have a concomitant right to have another attorney appointed for you. And in fact, United States versus Wheat, which is also a United States Supreme Court case, made that very clear in a footnote, that Ferretta doesn't mean that you have a constitutional right to have an attorney appointed to represent you when you have waived your right to representation. Then going on to the second case that Jones relies upon is Kaplan versus Drysdale, and I'm very confused about why that case would support Mr. Jones' position at all. That case really dealt with an attack on a forfeiture statute, and the defendant in that case said, I want to use the money that might be forfeited to pay for the attorney of my choice. Well, the court said that forfeiture statute is not unconstitutional because you don't have the right to pay for an attorney of your choice if you are indigent, and that oftentimes the ability to pay does come into this idea of what attorney you can afford to have, and perhaps you can get somebody to take the case pro bono and they will take it for the chance that your money won't be forfeited and they can have their money back. I don't see that supports an issue of the right to reject a first appointed attorney in any way. Then you get on to the rule, to the public defender's rule. The public defender's rule does not constrain the court's obligation under 977.081 to approve any new appointments, substitute appointments of counsel. It is the court's obligation to make that determination. Whether or not the public defender is willing at this point in time to give them one free substitution should be irrelevant to that, to a constitutional analysis. The court makes a determination. Sometimes the court will determine using the Lomax factors that, yes, indeed, you should, that attorney should be allowed to withdraw. You should have the ability to have a new attorney. And the public defender will say, no, they already had one free one. We're not going to do that. Then the court finds the county to pay for that attorney. On the opposite end, a court could be weighing the Lomax factors and find that no good cause was shown, no legitimate reason was mentioned for a new attorney, so that even though it's the first request and even though there may not be delayed, it's not appropriate in that case to...
Counsel?
Yes.
I want to start with the record and then go to the law on right to counsel, constitutional right.
Okay.
In the trial court, the issue arose in the posture of a motion to withdraw. Counsel filed a motion to withdraw. His client wasn't happy with him, so counsel filed that motion. Mm-hmm. At the motion hearing, and I'm reading from 152 of the appendices, Mr. Jones said, I wrote him many times because he never came to see me but one time in 7 months, and I wrote him 16 letters, and he never wrote me back. I don't want him to be my lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
And then a little later he says, I don't feel he's in my best interest because I think he's working with the DA. So we got a little problem here, you know, Houston. Now, after listening to that, the court then said two things about the constitutional right to an attorney. On page 154, the court says, I really haven't heard a reason to permit Mr. Wasluski to withdraw here. Defendants are not entitled to counsel of choice. There's nothing here that makes me think that the defendant is being deprived of the Sixth Amendment right to trial, and I'm denying the motion to withdraw. A page or so later, there's a brief reference to the defendants, a Sixth Amendment right to competent counsel. The defendant is getting that, so I suggest that he think carefully about cooperating with his lawyer. Okay, that's the record as I see it in the trial court. If this attorney were retained counsel, would the court's response be incorrect because
it would be different. It would be different because the right to retain counsel comes, and this is the Gonzalez-Lopez decision, is a structural error where it becomes directly out of the Constitution, and that with the constitutional right to retain counsel, you go in with the presumption that a person has the ability to use their own funds to pay for any attorney that they want.
Mm-hmm.
And in order to deny that right, you need to find out that there's things like delay, conflict of interest, that sort of thing. With appointed counsel, that derives from the Sixth Amendment right to effective assistance of counsel.
Let me jump in, because okay. I think the Gonzalez-Lopez case is a big case, but I don't know what people should do with it. I've read some articles about it, and they liken it to Scalia's confrontation analysis. You indicated earlier that the right to pro se representation is a long-established constitutional right. Well, I'm not sure the right to choose your own attorney
has been recognized as a long-established right. I think it was recognized as a separate right, separate from the right to effective representation of counsel, whether it's due process, Sixth Amendment. Mm-hmm. It wasn't recognized until 2006 in the Gonzales-Lopez opinion.
I would agree with
one
you.
One of the things that concerns me is, I have two things. Number one, I look at our Bill of Rights, freedom of speech, freedom of association, you know, go down the list. None of them have a credit check associated with that. In other words, if you have enough money, you can exercise that right. So there's something that's bothersome to me, that if you're rich enough, you can have a right to choose your attorney. But if you're middle class these days, because attorneys are expensive, or you're poor, you may not have that right. That's bothersome to me. Let me get rid of the middle class. If you're poor, if you're indigent, you don't have this constitutional right. You only have it if you're rich. Does that bother you?
Of course it does. Yeah, but
analytically, how can that really hold firm?
Well, because it goes all the way down the line. I mean, I couldn't afford the same kind of attorneys that O.J. afforded. I mean,
but we're talking about constitutional right. We now have recognized in 2006 a defendant has a constitutional right, separate from effectiveness, separate from Strickland. So how can that be based on if you have enough money in the bank, if you happen to have a job and you weren't laid off?
It's also a qualified right, and the qualifications are that you have enough money to choose the person you want to, and that you're not creating delays or conflicts of interest. But you know, there's the idea, and it does come back, is long-standing constitutional mm-hmm. idea from the founders, that a person has the right to spend their money in the way they see fit. And
Let me ask the second problem. Again, I think we're going to be seeing a number of unfolding issues, as we have in the confrontation context, that are going to be problematic with this proclamation. What about, as we see rather commonly in some counties anyway, that, okay, you don't qualify for indigency, but buddy or lady, you're going to pay. I'm going to appoint an attorney, but I'm going to have you reimburse. Does that person then, who's going to be paying, have a constitutional right to an attorney of choice?
I would say that, you know, and I'm not familiar with that situation, so I haven't really thought it through.
It's quite prevalent in the state.
It is. Well, I would say that if that person is paying, that person would have the right, the constitutional right, qualified right, to fire that attorney under the idea that they're paying. And they would also have the right to go pro se if they could do it knowing and voluntarily. But again, you know, it's something that I really
That's court-appointed counsel. That's not what we have here today.
No, it's
are you giving counsel. Up arguments regarding court-appointed counsel that a county
no,
sets a
no,
rate?
No, because I'm not familiar with this mm-hmm. situation. It is court-appointed counsel, but they're asking for reimbursement.
Yeah, that's right.
No, I think that's different, because I think there in many situations there are that reimbursements that are required of defendants for things that.
I'll tell you, I don't know the answer to my question. Mm-hmm. I just don't know what the ramifications are. But it seems like, you know, it strikes at my heart the idea that if you're rich, you have a constitutional right, but if you're poor, you don't. That just seems not
there. There is a constitutional right, and the constitutional right is that you are provided an assistance from attorney, and that attorney needs to provide you with appropriate.
Yeah. You know, I'm not talking about that constitutional right. You know that. I'm talking about a constitutional right under the Sixth Amendment, not for an effective assistance of counsel, which is a separate and distinct right under the Sixth Amendment, to an attorney, your right to choose your attorney. That's what I'm talking about, and the mm-hmm. ramifications for this state. What should we say to the trial court judges? This is really what I'm concerned with.
What kind of record should be made now that we have, in my opinion, maybe not shared by others, a robust Sixth Amendment right to counsel for those who can pay for retained counsel, right to choose counsel for retained counsel? What kind of record has to be shown? My first question to you was, would this be satisfactory? And of course, no. What should we be instructing our trial judges to do because of Gonzalez-Lopez?
Yeah. I think that actually the analysis is close to the Lomax analysis, but not the same. And I think that in the analysis with a court-appointed attorney, I think the initial thing that the court has to analyze is if there is any kind of good cause shown for the withdrawal, breakdown in communication that it goes to the extent that it would be as an ineffective assistance of counsel. And then you weigh in the factors such as the delay and conflict of interest. With a retained counsel, I think that initial burden on the defendant to show good cause isn't there, but there still has to be an analysis on whether it will cause delay, whether it will stress the system, whether
conflict
there's any
of
conflict
interest.
Of interest,
right.
whether there's an attorney that's willing to take it and available.
So you really need a balancing of an established constitutional right.
For retained counsel, you ask?
For retained counsel.
Yes, yes.
You need a much, you know, here the record is you're not entitled to it, but there's really no balancing that's evidenced, and
well,
I don't fault the trial judge because there wasn't a recognized right, you know, but there's no balancing, and you have to have a balancing test.
Well, I think the reason there wasn't and there was some balancing, but the reason that there wasn't a extensive balancing was the court's determination, and this was an appointed attorney, that there was no initial, they didn't come forward with any initial good cause or legitimate reason that would initiate a balancing. Excuse me?
You think that was the right way the trial court should have approached it and write in light of Gonzalez?
Yes, because I don't think Gonzalez applies here.
Absolutely not.
Absolutely not.
No right with appointed counsel.
No constitutional right. Yep. I don't think so. I think it's a discretionary decision, and it's based on Lomax. If you were to incorporate Jones's argument on that, you would be overruling Lomax. And the way that I interpreted what Jones is saying in the Discretionary Balancing Act is that you just sort of forget about good cause, and that that as long as there is no delay or conflict of interest, they're entitled to, because the public defender maybe has one available, that they're entitled to that. Now, I'd want to address that, too, that the administrative rule, there's no evidence in this record that there would have been another attorney available. No request was made for another attorney. We have what the appellate division, how they interpret the rule, and that's that you don't get a new attorney if the difference of opinion is just strategic or on the worth of the appeal. And what we've got in this situation, once you take the issue of deafness out of the picture, which you do because they're on remand was found that they were able to communicate, what you've got is just a difference of opinion on the validity of the case. What you've really got is Jones feeling like his court-appointing attorney didn't really believe in his innocence and was encouraging him to plead guilty. And there was a strategic difference on that, and that's really all there was in this case.
What about the 16 letters and no response and only
seven months? They found that at the hearing, which after remand from the Court of Appeals, that wasn't true, that there were more meetings than what the Jones had said there were. They were longer meetings, and that
there were more letters
more letters, there were more responses, there were more meetings, and I think they mentioned four instead of one, and they were for longer durations, so that the court believed that was not a valid concern either. Also, the only getting back to whether another attorney would have automatically been appointed by the public defender in accordance with the rule, Jones did write to the public defender complaining, and that letter did not say anywhere in it, well, you know, if you want, you can ask them to withdraw and we'll give you another one. You know, it said more or less, you should go and work with your attorney on this and let us know if there's further problems. So we don't know whether there would have been an available attorney. We also don't know whether that, if there was one appointed, whether that attorney would have had February 6th free in his calendar or her calendar. And again, there was a real concern about getting the hearing interpreters for the trial. There had been three adjournments to find hearing interpreters. Judge Lamelas was very concerned about having certified interpreters and the difficulties in getting them, and did the best she could to schedule those, and went in great length at the original, in the original decision, saying how difficult that had been, and that it was a real concern that that might, if indeed the court date had to be changed because there was a conflict with a court date of a newly appointed attorney, or if they couldn't get up to speed in time, that that would really delay it at for several months.
Suppose instead of a state public defender system, the state provided that for this kind of offense, we'll give you X thousand dollars and you can retain your own lawyer. I mean, you know, not everybody has the same system of fulfilling the constitutional requirement that people who are indigent be given counsel, okay? So he starts out and he then wants to fire the guy. Does he have a constitutional right under Gonzalez?
I don't believe so. I mean, it's really just the way this, it's still state money being used. It's the state fisc.
So if the state pays, you don't have the right. If your father pays or your company pays, you do have the right.
Yes.
There's a reference in one of the articles I read about states that have mandatory reimbursement provisions. And they weren't quite sure how this was all going to be playing out.
As a matter of fact, I'm going to ask Ms. Hennick whether my recollection is correct that the state public defender's office can get reimbursement.
I believe that might be true.
That was my recollection of having seen this in the records and having heard it. So what you have, even if you have a state public defender, the concept that the individual may be paying over, you know, 10 years at $20 a month, but that the person is obligated to pay. So it's very hard for me under those circumstances to say that it's not your own retained counsel.
I think we need to step back for a minute and say that you know, there's a long-standing, many decisions of the United States Constitution and the Wisconsin Constitution saying there is no constitutional right for
they were all person. Before Gonzalez. Before Gonzalez, would you have predicted that that's what the holding was going to be?
Yes, because I think that there were earlier the Kaplan case and the
that was a 5-4 decision, wasn't it?
I mean, I believe that there were earlier cases that held there was a constitutional right for retained counsel. The Gonzalez case really just assumed that that was right, and what they were talking about was what the remedy was. So the Gonzalez case really was relying on previous United States Supreme Court decisions.
Even if you have a retained counsel, the court can say you can't fire him, right? You got to go ahead.
Yes. Balancing out whether there's
delay. But
to
say you can't have them because there's a conflict of interest. We've had cases like that.
Or they're not qualified to practice in our jurisdiction, or there's a conflict.
That one was a Pro Hoc Vici case. Was that the Gonzalez one?
Yes.
Okay. So you've got all of this. So it's a qualified right. Isn't it easier to say and avoid the financial issue to say, everybody, appointed counsel, retained counsel, person has a right to say to the court, I don't want them. The court says, tough luck on you, buddy. We're going to trial in 2 weeks, and I'm not doing a continuance. Or, tough luck on you. You've already gone through 5 public defenders, and they're not going to give you anyone else, and we're not going to impose more funds on this. You're going with them. I mean, all of those exercises of judgment are permissible, even if you say you have a constitutional right to get rid of a counsel, right?
I think the difference is that when you are operating under the state fisc and the system of appointed attorneys, you put a stress on that system, and that has to be recognized. There are a limited amount of people who can take cases that will sign up to take cases at the amount that they're paid.
Sure.
Especially in the smaller counties, and that when you give this sort of immediate qualified but much more free ability to change counsel, it is a stress on the system. And in recognition of the stress on the public monies, on the court scheduling, on the ability to keep competent counsel and the public defender's list, that it has to be at least a good reason given for why you...
Sure. You've made a perfect balance. I agree. But that's different than saying, no right at all.
Well, in the way the right to retain counsel is set up is that you don't have to give a reason. And as
long... You may not have to give a reason, but if it affects the system, court doesn't have to grant it, does it?
That's correct.
Okay. Well, same thing here. You don't have to give a reason. You get one shot. But if it affects the system, you don't get it.
Well, I think with retained counsel, it's maybe not quite that easy. It's retained counsel that what I've seen in the cases is that you can get a new counsel without giving a reason. But if there's specific conflict of interest or some delay that's not appropriate, whereas with appointed counsel, you start out with the notion that you don't, unless you have some reason other than a strategic reason for wanting a new counsel, that you don't get to the balancing test. And it's because of the difficulty in operating a system of appointed counsel. Even the public defender will give apparently one free attorney. After that, how can a constitutional right be based on a public defender rule that says this is the standard for the first substitute attorney? Then there's no constitutional right after that. It's that the standard is entirely different after that, because the public defender has, at least at this point in time, decided that they're willing and able to give one free substitute.
Ms. Prey, how would you write this opinion?
I would write the opinion by saying there is no constitutional right in the Wisconsin Constitution or the federal Constitution to an indigent person to reject their appointed attorney. The standard for deciding whether a person can withdraw when you're talking about an indigent person and an appointed attorney is under Lomax. And under Lomax, the person has to make some showing of good cause, and that good cause is not just a strategic difference in how to handle the case. The good cause is equivalent to a finding of ineffective assistance of counsel, in the sense that you have to show some kind of prejudice, that there has been a breakdown of communication or a conflict of interest that threatens a just result in the area. And then if there is that kind of showing, the court goes on and balances, well, even if there is good cause, it may be that there should not be a new attorney appointed because it's too close to trial, the delay, and et cetera. And so that's what I would like seeing to come out of the court.
What is the impact of the administrative rule in this case?
I believe the administrative rule really is irrelevant for two reasons. One is that first, the court is the gatekeeper in these situations. I'm sorry. The court is the gatekeeper in these situations. Under 977.081, the court decides whether to appoint a new attorney. Only after the fact would come in who's going to pay for that new attorney. The court may decide that a new attorney should be appointed, and the public defender says, no, they've had their a couple of chances on this, then the court would have to find somebody, the county probably, to pay for it. Or the court will say, no good cause was shown, no good reason, after balancing it, no, I'm not going to allow that, even if the public defender would have appointed or paid for a new attorney. So that I believe the administrative code certainly doesn't, it regulates how the public defender uses its finances and assigns its attorneys. It does not create rights for defendants. It does not bind the court in any way. It's great that the public, I'm sorry, I have just one closing statement. Yes. It's great that the public defender has a generous policy in providing one free attorney. And it may be that it's because it's easier for them to do a blanket rule with all the issues, but that public defender rule cannot be imposed on the rest of the criminal justice system, the courts, the state, the victims. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Bray. Ms. Hemick?
I'd just like to make a couple of quick points on rebuttal. The first one is a factual point. The trial court never found that, in fact, those letters from May to July were answered. What the court did was it didn't make specific findings of this letter was sent, this letter was sent. What the court found was that they didn't believe that there was a substantial breakdown in communication. Those letters, in fact, were never answered. There was a meeting. The first meeting between them, other than right outside of court, was in August. As for the case, the rest of the case, I think that one of the things...
Counselor, wasn't there also a meeting that occurred either at Fox Lake Correctional or some other institution where he was confined?
Yes, but that's substantially later. That's, I believe, in January.
But it was before the motion was heard, correct?
No, it was not.
It was after
the motion was
okay.
heard.
Okay, thank you.
As for Lomax, I think one of the things that you're seeing is, I think you're seeing some substantial disagreement on what good cause is. And whatever this court does, that may be a point that this court may want to clarify. Because what you saw in the trial court, and I think what you saw from the Attorney General, was the notion that good cause has to be as weighty as counsel would not be effective counsel. And I don't think that's ever what Lomax said or intended to say, especially when you put it in light of their description of balancing. And I think you have to remember that Lomax is on the day of trial. As for reimbursement, yes, the public defender requests of defendants that they provide some monies towards their attorney. Sometimes that's collected, sometimes that's not. Sometimes it remains an obligation for quite a few years before there's any determination on that. And unless there are questions.
Is that done administratively or in the court system, the repayment?
It's done administratively. And the only reason that I know that is because when I get a case file, I don't deal with that, but I see the letter that went to the client. It's dealt with administratively. It does not go through the court system.
Because you will owe so much, whatever it is.
Yes, a letter will have gone out saying, you owe this much. You know, if you can't pay, here's what you do. If you can, here's where you send it, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. Part of that is a theory that people think if they don't have to pay for it, it's not worth anything.
It's because the legislature said that's the way we would handle it, and I'm not prepared to delve into what their reasons were. I really don't know.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hennick, and thank you, Ms. Frey. frequent visitors to the court system on criminal cases. Thanks for your briefs and your arguments today. That ends the hearing on 08AP2342CR, State versus White Glenn Jones. Students will come in to the courtroom and await Justice Bradley, who will talk about the procedures of the court, and everyone is invited to attend. We are in recess until 1:30, when we will hear our third case.